Today's episode is brought to you by Canby Foursquare Church. Since 1978, a place to grow, connect, and serve. In-person services are back with some restrictions to help ensure everyone stays safe and healthy. For the latest, visit their website at canbyfoursquare.com.
Welcome to Now Hear This, Canby,
your source for news.
The threat of a possible teacher strike was avoided this week.
There's a new irresistibly cute creature winning over fans, and its name is Scootaloo.
Sports?
It's like Lucy in the football. You want to kick a field goal, but they take it away from you.
We had to learn how to win.
Goal can't be in the last second of the game!
And interesting conversations.
Because I'm one of the strongest girls ever, and I know that for a fact.
I just really enjoy writing gossip as if I was a bear.
With an old maid daughter that make the best moonshine in the coast.
If it would have hit me in the face, I think I would have died. I really do.
I guarantee you would have died, man. Are you kidding me?
Hey, friends, and welcome to this episode of Now Hear This, Canby. I am your host, James Walton. Let's read the news. County commissioners are again distancing themselves from their fellow commissioner, Mark Scholl, who is less than a year into his first term and has already sparked numerous controversies for airing far-right views on social media that have been condemned as racist, Islamophobic, xenophobic, and anti-Semitic. In the latest, Scholl shared a post on his personal Facebook page that appeared to compare vaccine mandates and other COVID-19 measures to the state-sponsored persecution and genocide of millions of Jews in Nazi Germany during the Holocaust. Scholl defended the post during a Board of Commissioners meeting Tuesday morning, saying, quote, "It was blown out of proportion." But all four of his colleagues, including Chair Tootie Smith, were sharply critical in a statement from the county that came out a few hours later, in which commissioners said, quote, "There is no place for hatred and bigotry on the Board of County Commissioners or in the county." Commissioners said Scholl's post was dismissive of the horrors the Jewish community endured during the Holocaust and promised to support and stand by Clackamas Countyans of Jewish descent in the face of racism and bigotry. Scholl has been the target of numerous calls for his resignation pretty much since being sworn in, after years of Facebook posts were unearthed that were widely considered racist and Islamophobic. All four commissioners joined that call and voted to censure him in the wake of that controversy, then stripped him of his board authority and committee assignments following a later furor in which he repeatedly described a hypothetical vaccine passport as the second coming of the racist pre-civil rights era laws known as Jim Crow. He is currently facing a county-wide recall effort, which also released a statement Tuesday blasting Scholl for his latest comments, with local labor activist Ira Erbs, a child of Holocaust survivors and a leader of the recall campaign, calling them, quote, "yet another confirmation of why Mark Scholl is unfit to lead this county." The campaign is currently fundraising and collecting contact information for those who plan to sign the recall initiative, but has not yet filed the petition to formally start the signature collecting effort. History was already not on lawmakers' side this week as they began the once-in-a-decade task of redistricting, something the legislature has failed to bring to the finish line 80% of the time over the past century, forcing the Secretary of State and Judiciary to finish the job. But it's likely that few expected things to unravel quite so quickly. After the Senate on Monday quickly passed the maps proposed by Democrats, which would give Oregon 5 progressive-leaning congressional districts and one solidly red one covering about half the state's landmass, House Speaker Tina Kotek shocked many Capitol observers by rescinding a deal she'd made to share power with Republicans in the redistricting process. After agreeing to a hard-fought compromise with Republican leadership last April, Kotek reversed course this week, replacing the bipartisan commission with two Democrat-controlled committees to complete the redistricting task. House Minority Leader Christine Drazen of Canby did not mince words in her response. Quote, "She lied and broke her promise, not just to us, but to Oregonians. Drazen said in a statement Monday. She just sold the soul of our state for Democrats' political gain. The maps favored by Democrats are heavily weighted toward their party's interests, according to a nonpartisan analyst like PlanSource, which found that a Democrat's vote would be nearly 12% more efficient than a Republican one under such a proposal, and that it would favor Democrat candidates in 80% of scenarios. Republican critics point out that it would allow Democrats to control 86% of Oregon's congressional delegation, despite Oregonians never giving Democrats 86% of the vote in a statewide contested election. Senate Minority Leader Fred Garrod, Republican of Lyons, said the proposal would, quote, rig the next 10 years of election to favor Democrats and unfairly weigh the Oregon congressional representation in favor of the city of Portland, which contains only about 15% of the state's population. But Democratic leaders defended both the maps and Kotek's about-face on the power-sharing deal, saying the GOP was to blame for refusing to fairly participate in the process and attempting to present their own gerrymandered maps. Throwing another wrench into the proceedings was the announcement Tuesday that work would be temporarily halted due to a confirmed case of COVID-19 at the Capitol building. In a statement Tuesday, Drazen urged Democratic leaders to take advantage of the situation to resume a bipartisan approach to the process that will shape the state's congressional delegation for the next decade. It's in the very best interest of Oregonians that we salvage an opportunity to pass fair maps, Drazen said. They deserve fair representation. We need fair maps for Oregon, and that's still possible. The city of Canby is now accepting applications to fill the remaining term of former councilor Jordan Tibbles, who abruptly resigned earlier this month due to moving out of state. The seat has been through quite the journey. Tibbles was elected in a hotly contested race last November, one that saw him snatch victory from the jaws of seeming defeat after trailing former councilor Jason Patton in early returns on election night. Unusually, Tibbles' term was for only 2 years because it was meant to fill the unexpired term of former councilor Tracy Height, who had actually been elected to hold it in November of 2018. Height relinquished the position barely 7 months into her second term, citing family and work commitments. A crowded field of candidates threw their hats into the ring to replace her, with Trygve Berge, a vice president of a commercial construction firm, emerging the victor. Of course, Berge himself stepped down in August 2020, also due to moving outside city limits, and the council opted to leave the position vacant until the election 2.5 months later. So, that means the seat Height originally won in 2018 will have been resigned from 3 times and held by at least 4 different people within the span of its 4-year term. Meanwhile, all other elective positions in Canby, including the mayor, have seen 0 resignations in that span, though former council president Tim Dale declined to seek re-election when his term expired last year. Per the city charter, those interested in serving the remainder of Tibbles' term will be interviewed by the mayor and remaining council members, and the successful candidate will be appointed to serve until December 31st, 2022. The deadline for applications is 5 p.m. September 30th. All qualified applications will be forwarded to the mayor and the council on October 1st, and interviews will be held in open session on October 6th. The new city councilor will be sworn in at the following meeting on October 20th. Diehard Canby sports fans have a new home for live local coverage of Canby area sports and athletics, Cougar Country, the latest brand innovation from the Canby Current and Now Hear This Media Group. The name, which encapsulates Canby's beloved Cougars and the community's fiercely independent small-town Americana identity, was the brainchild of Now Hear This co-owner Tyler Frankie. Now Hear This and The Current worked with a creative team to bring to the brand to life using CHS colors and past logos for inspiration. Frankie said the Now Hear This news team went into the fall season with one goal in mind, to bolster the outlet's sports coverage and to give local student athletes and coaches a taste of the recognition they richly deserve. In a press release Tuesday, he thanked the crew, including new additions Antonio Arredondo and Jordi Villagomez, for helping make that possible. Frankie said, quote, "Sports and other extracurricular activities are the lifeblood for a school district and places a strong sense of community identity like Camby." Initially, Cougar Country will be the brand name for the existing sports coverage appearing on CambyFirst.com, the Now Hear This Camby podcast, and the Current's social media properties. But Now Hear This is exploring the possibility of future endeavors, including a spin-off sports podcast and video content. To see brand samples, you can find the story on CambyFirst.com. Cougar Country hometown sports coverage is brought to you by Reif and Hunsaker. When you need an attorney, turn to the firm Camby has trusted for over 50 years. You can call them today at 503-266-3456. Camby boys soccer, in the midst of a brutal opening schedule to start their 2021 season, has had their hands full to open the year. Through it all, junior Sammy Baraja Silva has starred for the Cougars as a midfielder. On Saturday, Baraja Silva's leadership and skill were rewarded when he was announced as the Max Preps Unified Soccer Coaches Oregon Player of the Week. Despite his obvious talent, Barajas Silva is actually just in his first full season playing varsity soccer for the Cougs. After leading the JV squad his freshman year, Barajas Silva was sidelined for his entire sophomore campaign with an injury. Coming back after nearly 2 years of playing soccer and icing a lot more, Baraja Silva has scored one goal and tallied one assist and has helped immensely to stabilize the Cougar midfield. Sammy brings a calming presence to the squad as we can trust both his abilities and his intelligence on the field, said Camby boys soccer coach Ryan McCormick. All the guys have trust in him, and it's easy to see why. He sees the game at a high level. This past week saw Camby drop two tough losses to Lake Ridge and to Tualatin, the most heartbreaking of them being the game in which the Cougs jumped out to a 2-0 lead against the high-powered Timberwolves, only to give up five straight scores and fall 2-5. Despite the loss, McCormick pointed to Baraja Silva's ability as a main factor for keeping the game close. His coach says Baraja Silva has shined for Camby's interior and allowed them to keep stride with some of the best squads in the state. Through the first five games of the season, the Cougars have scored almost as many goals as they did during their entire spring campaign. Said McCormick, "What we have been able to take from the opening game is both appreciation for how far we've come from last year and a belief that when we play well and have everyone, we can play with anyone." Baraja Silva's award-winning week for the Cougars only bolsters his statement of a changing tide for the future of Camby boys soccer. And that will do it for the news of this episode of Now Hear This Camby. You can find more stories on our website at CambyFirst.com. I'm James Walton. Thanks for listening.
Attention hunters! The Camby Rod and Gun Club will be opening their 100-yard rifle range to the general public and club members later this month to give hunters and sportsmen the opportunity to ensure their firearms are properly sighted in before the hunting season kicks off. This year's sight-in days will be from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. the last two weekends in September, the 18th, 19th, 25th, and 26th. The cost is $5 per gun and $1 per chamber flag, which is refundable upon return. The Camby Rod and Gun Club provides the range officers, targets, experienced spotters, and coaches at each firing point to help with the sighting in process. The Camby Rod and Gun Club is located about a mile southeast of Camby on the Malala Forest Road. Maps and more information are available at CambyRodAndGun.org. No reservation necessary. Happy hunting. Over 70 years ago, a seed was planted in the rich, fertile soil of North Camby. The seed was Swan Island dahlias, and today it has blossomed and grown into the largest leading dahlia grower on planet Earth. Family-owned and operated, Swan Island is one of Oregon's premier agrotourism destinations, boasting 375 varieties and 40 acres of gorgeous blooms. A sea of color that is among the most jaw-dropping and unforgettable sights in the entire Pacific Northwest. While their fields and annual Dahlia Festival justifiably get a lot of attention, Swan Island has a lot of amenities you may not know about. Their selection of gifts, gardening supplies, and other unique finds is among the most expansive in Cambie area, and their fresh-cut flower shop, it's always worth stopping for. This summer, Swan Island is featuring a rotating menu of delicious food trucks Thursday through Sunday and a wide variety of fun classes for all interests and ability levels. The Dahlia Farm will also be hosting a local farmers market every Friday and live music shows through September. Swan Island and their amazing Dahlia Fields are open 6 days a week, 9 a.m. to 5:30 p.m., closed Wednesdays. For class registration, concert schedule, or more information, visit dahlias.com or follow Swan Island Dahlias on Facebook and Instagram.
Are you a healthcare hero? Do you want to become one? Are you looking for a position where you are valued, your time is your own, and you have ample opportunity for growth? Marquee companies at Hope Village in Cambie, Oregon offers all of that and more. They are currently hiring nurses, caregivers, CNAs, and enrolling students in their free CNA course. From competitive wages and up to $25,000 tuition reimbursement to flexible schedules and the opportunity to make a positive impact on someone's life, Marquee at Hope Village is the right place for you. Take your career to the next level and apply now to become a valued team member at Marquee at Hope Village in Cambie. To learn more or apply today, text CURRENT, that's C-U-R-R-E-N-T, to 888-906-3432.
I'm Tracy Berg, and I'm the Social Services Director at Marquee Hope Village.
Awesome. How long have you been here?
I have worked for Marquee for about 4 years, and I've been here for about 3.5.
Okay, cool. How did you get into this type of work?
I used to work in senior care as a waitress when I was in high school. And after college, I had a degree in management but didn't know what I wanted to do. And one of my friends said, "You love the elderly, why don't you turn that into a job?" So I went back and started working in an assisted living, then worked for Marquee Home Health, and then have been here ever since.
And you just love this type of work?
I love it. I absolutely love it.
Why?
Even on really hard days, I can see the difference that I make in people's lives in a tangible way. And if I show up and do what I'm supposed to do, it can be a really positive difference. And not everybody gets to see exactly what their work is doing in someone else's life the same way I get to see it daily. And I get to form really great connections with people at a really hard time in their life and hopefully help make it a little bit easier. And I love that. And the, working with the elderly keeps me very humble.
Yeah, what do you mean?
They always have a side comment or two to say. They always have suggestions for me that I did not ask for on what I should be doing, what I should be eating, who I should be dating, what I should be wearing. It goes on and on. So
gotcha.
They help me very much with living my life, I guess.
They grounded.
Yes, they keep me very grounded.
You mentioned earlier as well that some folks are kind of surprised at times by maybe some of your peers are surprised by how much you enjoy this work.
Yes. I heard a quote once that said something like, when you're doing what you're supposed to be doing, people around you will notice and it will wake them up a little bit. And that's how I feel in this job. I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing, and the people around me, it's like rippling out to them. And I can tell that's what I'm supposed to be doing. Early on, when I started working with seniors, I had a hard time not taking stuff home with me because this is a 24/7 job. And once I learned how to deal with not really having a boundary and it just became a part of who I am, it's gone really well. And it can be really hard, but it brings me so much joy too. And like I said, I can see the difference that I get to make. And I realize not everybody likes to work with the elderly. I work a lot with end of life care. So stepping in, you know, in those last couple months, weeks, days, hours, the first time I held someone's hand while they passed away, I realized I have the capacity to do this. I should probably do this.
Sounds so hard.
It is. It's not easy when we lose somebody, but when they are feeling safe and they're comfortable and the family knows what's going on, you can't really ask for more than that when you're coming to the end of your arc of life.
Yeah. And just the meaningfulness of that, like that just makes me think of what I do day to day. It's like, wow. Not on the same level.
It's just different. We impact people in different ways.
Thank you for saying that.
I mean it.
Tell me a little bit more about your specific role and what that means as far as social services director.
Social services is a little hard to explain. Half of my job is logistics. So I work a lot with insurances, with Medicaid services, checking boxes for the state, for each insurance, for Medicaid, just making sure we have things on the back end.
Yeah.
The other half of my job is whatever comes up.
Okay.
So pretty much anytime there's no specific person to handle something, it goes to social services. And that's another thing I enjoy about my job is there's never a boring day. It's never dull here.
Yeah.
Every time I think I've dealt with every situation, something new comes up and I get to figure out how we're going to manage that and navigate it.
So you do spend a fair amount of time still interacting with residents?
Oh gosh, yeah, absolutely. And any day I have a lot of paperwork, they seem to need me more on those days than on other days, but they ask for me by name or they come up to the office or ask for one of the social services folks. Amber, our care coordinator, and I share an office. So if it's not me they're looking for, it's Amber and vice versa. And they know how to get a hold of us.
I'm interested in hearing a little bit about the pandemic, not as a kind of official spokesperson or whatever, but just your personal experience and how it's been, how you've kind of experienced that, how it's changed your job, the challenges that it's been. What has it been like for you?
I've been pretty open about what I've gone through because I think it's helpful. I have to remember that not everyone has worked in healthcare during the pandemic, so my experience is different than other people's for sure.
Yeah.
Part of my job is to make sure that each individual resident's needs are being met and their rights are being respected. And when we first had the pandemic hit, and I remember having to tell someone, her husband came to drop something off for her and she wanted to kiss him goodbye. And I had to tell her no. And I had to go sit down for a second in my office after that because it's never been my job to keep people apart. It's been to build bridges to bring them together. So having to be the safety manager in that way, the gatekeeper, was really difficult. And fortunately, people understood that it was for safety, but it was still hard. We got hit very hard here with COVID in June of 2020, the worst month of my entire life. And I remember where I was when I found out, you know, you remember where you are in those big moments.
Yeah.
Someone had barely spiked a temperature and we immediately tested everybody. And by then it had already spread. And that's when I realized all of our planning, all of our training, everything we'd done in advance, all of our precautions, despite all of that, it had gotten into the facility and before it was even detectable, had spread.
Yeah.
And that hit me like a gut punch
because
I see these people every day and I work with their families and they feel like they're my loved one and my family member. And because I have those relationships, it was my job to call the families and tell them that their loved one had COVID. And that was a difficult call to make, but again, it made me feel better knowing that it was someone that they knew and trusted who was making that call. And, you know, I feel really honored that people trusted us with their loved ones and I was able to help them make those tough decisions Do we want to go out to the hospital and be on a ventilator? Do you want to stay here and just be kept comfortable? And everyone who passed away here had made that very clear with their family and with the facility about what they wanted. So we respected everybody's individual wishes, but it was really hard.
Yeah.
I had COVID, and because so many people were positive, I was able to keep working. I mean, it was just all hands on deck.
Yeah.
And even when I was at home, eventually our house physician sent me home because I was...
Just to make clear, at that time, they were having some positive residents, or staff work with positive residents, not...
Correct. So the majority of our residents were positive, and the few that were negative were moved to another end of the facility and partitioned off.
Yeah.
They did not ask me to keep working after I tested positive. I just kept coming in.
Yeah.
And we had a separate entrance we could go into and work with the already positive patients.
Yeah.
And at the beginning, I wasn't feeling the effects really, so I kept coming in. And eventually when I started really feeling the effects, the physician said, you have to go.
Yeah.
But I was so anxious at home. I brought my laptop home and my roommate had to take it away from me because I was refreshing everybody's notes too often. She was like, you can check it once an hour. So I came back pretty quickly. It was hard to be here, but it was harder to not be here.
Yeah.
When you have something like this as your job, you don't get to pull your heart out of it.
Yeah.
So my heart was here the whole time. These were my loved ones and their families that were suffering. And so it was hard to be involved in that, but I felt like all of the staff that were here, I mean, we had staff volunteer to come and work, which was really amazing and helpful because then they, their hearts weren't tied into it as much. They could just go about their business and, you know, our staff who were sick or who were just, their hearts were hurting, they were able to take a little bit of a step back.
Yeah. You mentioned how you first got into this work by noticing that you had this capacity in yourself to kind of handle those really tough moments,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, a little bit outside of what most of us can normally handle from our job. Did you feel like that experience specifically kind of showed you new depths within yourself that you didn't realize were there?
That's absolutely right. I still liked coming into my job even during the pandemic, even during June 2020. I don't think I would have liked it if that's when I had started working here, but I was already so entrenched in all of this that it made it possible to keep coming in. Being able to make those phone calls and be the liaison with families took it off the shoulders of another staff member who then was able to go out and work on the floor. So we all just came together and did our piece, and everybody worked to their capacity. And I knew that I was able to have those tough conversations and bear the anger or frustration or fear from family members and from residents who I had to tell, you know, you tested positive. I knew I was able to carry that because I'd carried it in small ways before. So I knew I could shoulder that.
Yeah.
And that would be my part of what I would do for us. There was one time where it really broke me, and I walked out of the facility into where they're developing back here. It was just a field, and I walked in there and I just fell down and cried. I cried for maybe 10 minutes. And then I walked around for 5, and then I came back in and called more families. So, I mean, you find ways to, sometimes it gets to you and you have to step away, but
yeah.
You come back in and you keep going with the patients you still have.
Is that a specific thing that happened or just a pile of that?
I had a family member who I had been talking to every day to give updates on her sister. And we had all of the decisions in place, but she just kept hoping a miracle would happen, and we kept hoping. And when that patient died, I called the sister, and she had talked to me the day before and had just begged me, please, please. And it was so tough to have that conversation. I would do anything I could, but there was nothing we could do. And to know she had just begged me the day before and to have to call her the next morning and say it happened, you know, she went this morning. There was just this silence that hung on the phone where I didn't want to hang up, she didn't want to hang up, but neither of us had any words.
Yeah.
And eventually she just said, I'll call you later, and hung up. And that was really when the weight of it hit me, that we were so helpless, and that despite our team doing everything they could, the patient had made their wishes clear. They didn't want any drastic heroic measures, and we respected that. But beyond that, there wasn't anything that we could do. And just feeling that helpless to help people, which is my job, that was what really got me in that moment.
So hard. I just want to tell you how much I admire you and your team being in that type of situation that's so difficult and so important, caring for this generation of vulnerable people who have so much wisdom and so much still to offer our community, and who have done so much for our community. I can do it. I just respect and admire the hell out of you guys for that.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. I think it's a good thing to keep in mind. This pandemic has gone on a lot longer than any of us expected. And it's, I think everyone's kind of at their breaking point in one way or the other. But keeping in mind, when you're dealing with healthcare workers who are enforcing a policy or giving you information, that these are some of the burdens that they're carrying is from situations like this.
Yeah.
I think that's just a good frame of reference to have in mind.
I wanted to hear and ask you about how things have been sort of post-vaccine. Have you been able to do a little more? Residents have been able to open things up a little more, and morale has kind of improved because of that. Obviously, still being very safe and regulated and whatnot, but things are different.
Yes, thank goodness. Marquee was great about getting us the vaccine as soon as they were able to. So I got my first dose at the end of December.
We were one of the first in the state.
We were some of the first in the state. And being able to call the families and tell them we have the vaccine and tell the residents, I mean, it was tears of joy. And I will never forget after there's a husband who lives in the facility and a wife who lives out in the community. And after he and she had both received the vaccine, the first time that she came in and was able to come in and visit with him without the barrier between them. And I told her that she could hug him, and they both just started crying. And I'm going to cry again, but I started crying. And they just stood there holding each other for maybe 5 minutes. I mean, just not saying a word, but just not being able to have that physical contact for so long, and then being able to touch each other again and really feel tangibly, you're okay, you're here, you're still warm, you know, that was amazing. And we've been able to make the vaccine available for residents and staff, but also for family members of staff and family of residents and community members. So it's been great to be able to have people call and say, you know, the wait times or this or that, and say, come on down. We've got our clinics on Wednesdays. We'll get you a dose.
Yeah.
And being able to have people be back in the dining room eating together again and be able to do some events and just see things start to go, not back to normal, but more in that direction. Yeah. It's bringing so much life back to us and bringing so much life back to the residents.
Yeah.
Getting choked up, literally.
can you just see, you know, even in the faces, the difference in the residents' morale and things like that?
They have things they're looking forward to again. You know, we haven't really had an end in sight, and there's still not, like, you know, a set date on the end of the pandemic, but they're knowing that we're heading in the right direction, and they're able to see more and more of what they love to do during the day starting to be able to happen again. And it may look a little different. Like, we, for example, we're doing bingo in shifts, so we don't fill the room and crowd it, but they're still getting to go back to playing bingo with each other. And we have some very competitive bingo players.
Yeah.
So being able to be back there and talk some trash to each other and win some prizes and do that again. You know, it doesn't look the same as it did before, but we're starting to get to do that again. And for people who their lives look very different here than they did at home, starting to have those things back to normal a little bit, it's just huge. It's huge.
Yeah, awesome. last thing I wanted to ask you about, Tracy, something you mentioned right near the start of this interview is how you've been very open about your experience as a healthcare worker. You recognize that there are many people in the community that are not, don't have those shared experiences, maybe don't have a loved one who does, and really have no sort of firsthand understanding of what that's been like. Is there anything else you would like to share just sort of with the general public at this moment in time about what you know from your job and the folks that you work with and sort of your day-to-day that you haven't already mentioned that you think would be important for people to know?
Well, I don't want to take a stance on a lot of things. Like you said, I don't represent Marquee, but I had COVID in June of 2020, and I'm a healthy 30-year-old, and I was just at the cardiologist again yesterday for a follow-up appointment. So just a reminder to everybody, please be safe, whatever that looks like to you. I think it's easy for people to write this off as something that only affects the elderly, and it did here, but we, some of us who had it are still having long-term effects from it that's limiting our daily life a year and a half later. So just being an example of what that looks like and being open about that, I think has been helpful. It's not to lecture anybody, but it's because I don't want anybody else to go through what I've been going through or what's unfortunately some of my coworkers have been going through back from when we had COVID in 2020. So just a reminder to people, be safe, because it's affecting everybody. The second thing would be that people come to us on their worst day, on a really bad day. We get, no one wants to be in a skilled nursing facility. No one wants to leave their home. I mean, we're not getting people at the best time of their life. We're getting them in the sunset years, as they say. But it's a very confusing process. Healthcare, senior care, insurances, the different types of facility, all of that. I would say that myself and others of our team members, our job is to be here, to be a resource. Even if you don't have someone at Marquee, we're here to help navigate that. And I think people wait too long to ask for assistance or don't ask someone who's already walked through it previously. And we are here to be able to help guide you through that. If you have questions about what skilled nursing is, or when someone should be in a nursing home versus an assisted living versus an independent living, all of those types of questions. I've been through all of this many, many times, and I'm here to be a resource to you. So I would tell people, reach out more, ask questions, call and ask for social services at a facility and just tell them you want general information, and we're here to help. We don't bite. They don't hire us if we bite. So please, I get the mask too. That's right. I can't really do a good job of biting as it is. So just to encourage people to just contact us and reach out. We're happy to help. That's why we're here. We love taking care of seniors, and that's not for everybody. So let us be a resource in that way.
Well, thank you so much, Tracy, for taking the time out to talk to us today. I really appreciated hearing some of your story.
Thank you for saying that. I clearly love what I do, and I love working for Marquee and love working in the senior care industry. So you follow up questions, you just come back, tell me how much time you have, Tyler, and we'll take care of them. Thank you for coming out.
Hey, Frankie, what are you doing?
I'm trying to figure out how to switch to a different TV provider now that DirectLink is ending its video services as of January 2022. It is so confusing. Did you know there are about 48 million streaming services now? Which devices do they work on? What channels do they offer?
No, I did not know that. But you do realize that if you have their easy video service now, you're already using a streaming service, right? But listen, you don't have to go this alone. DirectLink is actually helping members transition to their next video provider, offering an extensive informational website and live tutorials on alternative solutions, and even providing direct assistance to members who need it.
Wait, they're actively helping their members switch to a competing service? Who does that?
Well, DirectLink does, I guess. It's just one more chapter in their long history of caring service in Canby and wanting the best for our community. They've actually offered free community classes to teach their members about the latest technology and internet security practices for the past 12 years. That's not even to mention the popular bingo game they organized to help keep homebound members entertained and connected over the winter and fall, and extending free and reduced internet connections for Canby school kids learning from home during the pandemic, or their partnership with the city of Canby to implement free Wi-Fi at 3 local parks.
Whoa, DirectLink does all that?
Well, they do indeed, and that's on top of providing the best and most reliable internet service in town with the intent to cover everywhere with fiber optic technology in the next few years. In fact, you can learn more about DirectLink services or how they can help you transition to the right video service provider for your home. You can go to directlink.co-op today.
Hi, I'm Megan Waterman. I'm the owner and operator of the Book Nook in Canby, Oregon.
And I'm Tyler Clausen of Now Hear This Canby, the show you're listening to. Megan, the Book Nook is one of my favorite places in all of Canby. It's a one-stop shop for gifts, board games, new books, used books, and books from local authors. Why did you decide to open it?
Well, I love the power of a story. I love how reading about different people and places, times, stretches my mind. It makes me see the world differently, whether that's a fantasy story or a biography. It all changes the lens that I see and how I interact with people. The reason that we added games to our store is for that same reason. It's just a different way to experience story through gameplay.
And along with new selection, you're at a new location, right?
We are. We just moved, technically just across the intersection to the old Parsons building. We've expanded our space and also our selection. So we've got more books, more gifts. We added a larger gaming section. And now with the world opening back up a little bit more, we're starting to relaunch some of our events. We have relaunched our general fiction and our fantasy book clubs, and those are going great. And we're about ready to kick off game nights, starting with our beginner Dungeons and Dragons camp, led by Canby's very own Tyler Clausen.
Hey, that's me! If you're interested in D&D, make sure you stop by the Book Nook and get more information about role-playing opportunities there.
Yeah, or stop by anytime and chat with one of our booksellers about their current book recommendations and let us help you find your next favorite read. We're now open on Sundays as well, so we're there 7 days a week.
Nice. The Book Nook is in downtown Canby or online at booknookcanby.com.
Canby Then is brought to you by Retro Revival. They are not your average antique shop. They're open daily, and you can find them on the corner of Northwest 3rd and Grant Street in downtown Canby. If the city of Canby were a wheel, then Waite Park would be the hub. The city revolves around it. It is the host of many of the city's most popular and well-known events, from the Canby Independence Day celebration, once known as General Canby Days, to Light Up the Night, which draws thousands to downtown Canby each year to help ring in the holiday season. Today marks the start of a new series on Canby Then, looking at the history of the city's parks. They play a much more important role than you may realize. They are the places children play, yes, but one day those children grow up, and the lives they lead and the futures they build are shaped in no small part by the dreams that first began to take shape on the playgrounds of their youth. Waite is the city's oldest park. Though it was not officially deeded to the Canby until 1967, its history goes back much further than that. The property that would one day become Waite Park was part of the original 1870 plat for the city of Canby filed 150 years ago. It was part of the original donation land claim of Canby that founding father Philander Lee, the Oregon Trail pioneer who grew amazing whiskers, but also apples, which he shipped by train and sold to miners during the California Gold Rush. Just to the north was the claim of Aaron E. Waite, whose descendants would eventually own the land and donate it to the city, and after whom the park is named. Waite is a fascinating and influential figure in early Oregon history. It is well known that he was the first Chief Justice of the state's Supreme Court, but he was so much more than that. Aaron Waite was born in Whatley, Massachusetts, on the day after Christmas in 1813. His father was a soldier in the War of 1812, which actually lasted until 1815, and was killed in action shortly after Aaron was born. He was raised by his uncle and grandfather. At the age of 14, he became an apprentice broom maker in Hatfield and put the money he earned towards his own education. At age 20, he moved to Long Island, New York, where he taught country winter schools and was an assistant teacher in Erasmus Hall, though he would later confess he never really liked teaching. He eventually returned to Massachusetts before moving west in 1837 and settling in Centerville, Michigan. There, he befriended Judge Columbia Lancaster, who would also be influential in the early governance of both Oregon and Washington state. Young Aaron had taken an interest in political matters since he was a boy, a biographer once noted, and he had always been a Democrat. During the presidential campaign of 1844, he edited a Democratic paper in Michigan and afterwards held the office of military secretary in the cabinet of Governor John L. Berry. In the spring of 1847, Waite headed to the Oregon country in a wagon train of 40 ox-drawn wagons. His party included Judge Lancaster and Lancaster's small family. They arrived safely in mid-September of that year. Watchful care was exercised, and no serious accident nor difficulty occurred on the journey, Waite's biographer noted. Other than being tiresome, the journey was not an unpleasant one. The one colorful episode history preserves involved the spectacles Waite wore for nearsightedness. Native Americans who noticed the strange facial adornments asked what they were for, and Waite said they allowed him to see a long way off. The natives avoided him after that. They had misunderstood his explanation to mean that the spectacles made it so he could see anything, anywhere. Once in Oregon, he set up a law practice in Oregon City and entered into an agreement with Oregon's first governor, George Abernathy, to edit the fledgling Oregon Spectator. The Spectator was the first American newspaper west of the Rocky Mountains and would soon become the main paper of the region, used by politicians for public debate of the leading topics of the day. It had little competition. Before the Spectator, the only newspapers circulated in the territory were tiny pamphlets printed in San Francisco and Monterey, which were delivered by ship at random intervals, and, bizarrely, a paper based in Honolulu, Hawaii, which at the time was commonly known as the Sandwich Islands, for reasons that are much less hilarious than you might guess. Some folks also received letters and papers from the States once a year by immigrants coming down the Oregon Trail. When the Cayuse War broke out, sparked by the massacre of missionaries Marcus and Narcissa Whitman, whom Philander Lee and his family had met on their own journey to Oregon, Waite was appointed first assistant commissary under General Joel Palmer. While in that capacity, Waite was tasked with securing provisions for the troops in the field. No easy task. Legend has it that someone told him, "Go to God Almighty Smith." He was able to give. "He won't, but you try him." This Alvin Thompson God Almighty Smith was an accomplished carpenter on the Tualatin Plains, which we know now as the city of Forest Grove. He was, in the word of one historian, a serious man who did serious work. He was a devout Christian from his boyhood days. His nickname had been bestowed on him by the Indians, who heard his frequent prayers to God Almighty. And as one of his contemporaries, Dolly Hinman, would recall, quote, "Mr. Smith was a very stern man, keeping the Sabbath from sundown Saturday to sundown Sunday, and woe betide anyone who did not do likewise." Obviously, Aaron Waite had his work cut out for him. He arrived at Mr. Smith's late in the day and made his errand known. Never one to make a quick decision, Mr. Smith said, "You must stay with me all night, and we will talk it over." Well, old man Smith must have heard a still, small voice during his prayers that night, because he did indeed agree to furnish equipment for the soldiers in the field and rendered other aid. He even accompanied Waite to another settler's ranch near the foothills, where the two men procured a drove of hogs for the War Department and its hungry soldiers. God Almighty Smith's home still stands on Elm Street in modern-day Forest Grove. It is the second oldest building in the city and was added to the National Register of Historic Places in 1974. That house fell into disrepair and was even home to a meth lab in 2005, but was saved through the heroic fundraising efforts of the Friends of the Historic Forest Grove, which raised $175,000 to purchase and restore the property. Their efforts included, and I'm not kidding, a sexy calendar featuring members of the group in various nude poses. We were told it was quite tasteful. The name of the calendar, of course, was The History Buffs. God only knows what the good Alvin Smith would have thought about that. We'll have more to tell you about the adventures of Justice Aaron E. Waite and the Canby Park that bears his name, but it'll have to wait till next time on Canby Then.
Hi, everyone. Donna Ellison. Hannah Ellison with Ellison Team Homes. We wanted to come and talk to you today because we're super excited. A couple of things we're doing this month. We are one of the sponsors for the Canby Rodeo. Can't wait to see the rodeo because we love that. And the fair and all the kids. We've missed it for so long. So come see us this week at Canby Rodeo. Get your giddy on. And then the other thing we want to talk to you about, which is kind of the biggest news all year in Canby, is that we're back to being able to do our Canby Big Night Out and our Weekend Out.
Gonna be amazing. We have live music. All of the local businesses are showing up and supporting in any way they can, whether having food, having a tent. There's gonna be so many activities for kids to do. Also, stuff for adults as well. There's gonna be dancing. And we actually are gonna have
a dunk tank. And we're super excited. Right, my goal, which I think I'm hitting it, is to have at least one kind of well-known person every hour that we can throw balls to knock that person in the dunk tank. I'm not going to drop any names because I'm not that kind of a girl, but I will tell you we're going to have some really fun people that you're probably going to want to throw some balls at. We're going to do that part of it as a fundraiser for Fido Animeals. You probably already know we partner with them so that we can help coming into this time of the year. Big needs for animals, which is really seniors and veterans and people that are not able to buy food. So we're doing that portion as a fundraiser. We're gonna have swag. Come see us. We're super excited. The rest of our team, we can't wait to see you. It's been a long time. We're gonna be outside. Of course, we'll be taking all of the precautions to make everybody safe. So come hang out and have fun with us. There are some things we'll never understand. Singing, oh, that sound, that sweet, sweet sound.
Tyler, did you know that the Australian lyrebird can mimic any sound that it hears, even chainsaws?
No, that's super interesting.
Did you know that a baby puffin is called a puffling? That baby sea otters can't swim, so their moms wrap them up in pieces of kelp until they learn how to paddle?
Wait, do you know any trivia that isn't like animal related?
Not really, but here's some stuff you may not know about the Wild Hare Saloon, where Canby goes to eat and have fun.
Okay.
The Wild Hare is one of Canby's longest running locally owned restaurants. Owners Joan and Darren Moden have been in business for 16 years.
That's cool.
Yeah, heck, you were just a baby back then. And they love to give back. They've been members of the Canby Chamber for that long, and they donate over $20,000 to local sports, FFA programs, and civic organizations each year.
Wow, I'm legitimately like caught off. That's cool.
Yeah. They also support more than 30 jobs in the community through their award-winning staff, some of them as young as 18. Hey, that's older than you are.
I'm 10 months younger than you.
With the days getting longer and the weather getting warmer, the Canby Wild Hare's expansive outdoor patio is the place to be. Furry friends, welcome.
Well, that sounds great. I'm going to go check them out just off of Highway 99E next to the Space Age in Canby at 1656 Beaver Creek Road in Oregon City, or on their website at thewildhairsaloon.net. Now Hear This Camby is produced by me, Tyler Clausen. Our content director and star reporter is Tyler Frankie. And of course, our show is edited by Cameron Clausen. We also feature the vocal talents of Joy Struby and James Walden. So a round of applause to them. The song that you're hearing right now is Camby by singer-songwriter Olivia Harms, used with her permission. To find more work from her, you can visit her website, olivia13.com.
Now Hear This Camby is dedicated to preserving independent local journalism and redefining local news with our fun, fresh, and energetic brand of storytelling. Our sincere thanks to our local sponsors who make this show possible. Please show your appreciation by supporting the small businesses who support us.
The production of Now Hear This Studios, Camby's locally owned, full-service audio, video, and media production company. Our mission is to produce the best content in the universe, and we'd love to help you do it. Find us online at nhtstudios.com.
I will take a motion to adjourn.
I just moved it.
I didn't even ask for it, though.